Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Intellectual property and the associated types of patents, marks, and copyrights are things product managers need to know about. So I talked with a great patent attorney to better understand the issues and the options. I think you'll find the interview very valuable. The detailed notes of the discussion are at theeverydayinnovator.com/039. This is Chad, your host. I want you to also know about productinnovationeducators.com, where I and other experts provide online training for product managers, developers, and innovators. Product Innovation Educators makes this podcast possible. Now to the interview. Hi, everyone. Patents, trademarks, and copyrights make my head spin, but any good product manager or innovator needs to consider the intellectual property issues when developing a product. So I've asked patent attorney Dan Breen of the Webb Law Firm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to help all of us everyday innovators navigate the IP issues with new product development. Dan is an experienced patent litigator and prosecutor, primarily working with mechanical, electrical, and software technologies, all my favorites. So he brings a good mix of hardware and software IP experience. He also teaches at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. And this interview is part of my continuing design series, as Dan contributed the Intellectual Property Protection for Designs chapter to the PDMA Essentials book, Design and Design Thinking. Dan, thanks so much for helping us consider IP issues and how they apply to product management.
Thank you, Chad. Very happy to be here.
You know, most of us have had some idea in the past for a product, and a lot of us are working on those now. And some of these are just fun, right? That whether we've actually had a chance to execute on them or not. I was curious, what has come up in your past that may have stimulated a product idea for you?
Well, you know, it's funny. If we're talking about the past, it makes me think of the pretty distant past. When I was probably 7 or 8 years old, I remember vividly driving with my father through a fairly dark and windy, you know, mountainous road. And it occurred to me that, you know, as we're turning left, the headlights still point straight ahead, and you really can't see what you're doing as you're trying to navigate your way through this dark, you know, pathway. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be great if somehow you could connect the gears, you know, that allow the wheels to turn to something in the headlights that would allow the headlights to turn? And, you know, I was, 7 years old. I didn't really do anything with that, and I never came back to it. But I remember about 3 or 4 years later, I saw an ad for a Lexus car that had that feature in it. And I thought that was really interesting. And I find it more interesting now as a patent attorney, because there are just a lot of interesting patent implications that come up when, you know, somebody has an idea, they don't do anything with it, and then somebody else shows up and beats them to market. And of course, 7-year-old isn't marketing cars, but you get the idea, the trade-offs that you have to live with if you do have any ideas, and what you choose to do and what you choose not to do. As a patent attorney, I've seen this happen, you know, many, many times across a number of different clients. And knowing the patent system and knowing how you're expected to conduct yourself with respect to the system makes all the difference between having a million-dollar idea like turning headlights and just being a kid with an idea that's fun to think about but doesn't really do anything for you.
Right, yeah. It's always, you know, ideas are a dime a dozen, and it's the people that take the action that actually make the difference. And I'm with you on having a similar sort of experience. Like, why don't our headlights actually look where we're going? And I remember there was some movie on a car manufacturer that didn't make it. I wish I could remember the name that had this. I remember specifically in the movie. And I think Studebaker actually had turning headlights on one of their cars. So hopefully we'll see some more advancements in this. It's still a problem. This is one of the issues involved in IP protection, you know, that you need to think about the implications. Let's create a foundation for our discussion. And just, you know, generally, can you share the purpose of IP protection and why it exists?
Sure. So IP stands for intellectual property. And unlike real property or personal property, like, you know, your house or your car or your phone, intellectual property is intangible. It's something you can't see, smell, touch, or taste. It's just not, it's not in the physical world. It's intellectual. So intellectual property as a legal concept exists to make those concepts in some respect appropriable or ownable. And the way that they do that is by coming up with a legal construct that, even though I can't point to my idea, I have rights that control the use of my idea. So in essence, that's the basis of intellectual property. And the reason, the core reason why we have laws that cover and protect intellectual property is because not only is it intangible, but it's also appropriable and inexhaustible. So appropriable, I mean, once I tell you my idea, you can certainly take it and use it yourself if you would like. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, it's also inexhaustible, because if you steal my phone, you know, when I'm not looking off of my desk, well, you've taken one phone. But if you steal my idea, not only have you been able to take my idea, but that idea can then be shared infinitely with everybody else on the planet. It's not just one-to-one, you take my phone, I'm without a phone. But once an idea is out there, it's very difficult to contain the flow of that information without some sort of legal construct like intellectual property.
And there must be a stage here, right? Because I mentioned, you know, ideas are a dime a dozen. We don't want to protect all those ideas. So it's those that we're taking action on that we think are going to, you know, become viable products for us. And I've heard it said that IP protection is something that we want to act on sooner than later. There's this issue of prior art. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, so especially in the patent context, prior art is a key concept. And basically, prior art it's a term of art, and it refers to the universe of public knowledge that's out there in the world before a certain date. That date usually being the filing date of your patent application. Anything that happened prior, that happens to contribute to the technological field, you know, the art, is considered prior art. So this would include something that was published, something that was given in a presentation, something that was patented either here or maybe somewhere else in the world. All of those things that are publicly knowable or published are treated as prior art. And the idea in the patent system is that we only reward inventions and innovations that are new compared to the prior art. This is called the novelty requirement. And also things that are not just new, but also inventive, or the term of art in patents is non-obvious. It wouldn't have been obvious to make that difference and come up with your invention. So it's not just enough that, you know, I come up with some trivial minor change to something that's in existence. I don't get a patent for that. Maybe that's a new improvement, but it's not actually an inventive improvement. So that's the issue with prior art. Everything that's come before can show that your invention is either old or is a trivial minor distinction over what's already in existence. So all things being equal, you want to minimize the amount of prior art that could be held against you and be used to show that your invention is either old or at least modest. That's why the earlier you have your patent application file, the less that came before can be cited as prior art against you.
Okay, so there is kind of the sense of the clock running. And it seems like a lot of our, you know, really breakthrough innovations, there's groups of, you know, disparate people that happen to be working on the same idea in some means at the same time, right? Like the Wright brothers weren't the only ones working on trying to make a manned airplane, right? Get someone up in the air. So the first one to actually get the IP protection, then they have less issues to deal with if there's others that already have the idea out there in the public space.
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, I mean, I think that's right. The folks who are able to come, when you have what are called patent races or invention races, you know, the folks who sort of finish that process first and are able to get their patent protection first are usually in a far better position than anybody else. Until the Patent Act was amended in 2011, the United States focused on the first to invent being the person or the entity that gets the patent. And the rest of the world was sort of a race to the patent office. Whoever got there first, even if they were the last or the later person to have invented the same subject matter, the person who got to the patent office first would get the patent. And in the US, we would do a more deep analysis about who actually invented it first and the first inventor would be allowed to get the patent. So there are some nuances there. But all, again, all things being equal, being the first to innovate or being the first to get your patent application on file is always the best mm-hmm. practice. In reality, it's not always easy to get your R&D done quickly, and sometimes rushing to the patent office too quickly can actually do more harm than good for you if your patent application isn't really mature enough with enough detail to provide the patent office with the technical information that it's going to need.
So let's explore the timeline for this a little bit and what your advice is for it. So let's say a large company, standard product management kind of funnel, where maybe they have 100 ideas they're kind of working with, right? And then they have a selection process and they decide they're actually going to take 10 of those and take real action on those 10 to see if it makes sense to develop them for the market, right? So they're developing a business case on those 10, doing some market research. And maybe they end up putting all 10, they start putting them through development. And at some point they decide, you know, for various reasons, you know, only 4 of them look like they're really going to be viable. And they end up only doing a launch on 4 of those. So we went from, you know, big picture, 100 things we're interested in, 10 that we're actually taking some action on, and 4 we put out to the market. In that kind of a pipeline system, where should we be looking at thinking about getting involved with IP protection?
Well, I think it's something that should be considered at all stages. It's certainly not the only thing that should be considered at all stages. I mean, a patent isn't the key to success. Obviously, the kind of market research that you were referring to as the pipeline gets narrowed is far more important in the long run to make sure that that you're going to have a product that's worthwhile at the end of the day. There's sort of a trade-off. I mentioned this a moment ago that mm-hmm. you generally want to get your patent applications on file early, but you can't get them on file so early that the details of the invention aren't all there yet.
Right.
So I would say getting a patent attorney involved earlier is going to be good, because you can work with your patent attorney to find that right balance where the invention has been developed enough, you know, the concepts are mature enough that we now know at least what direction we're heading with in this technology. And that's a good time to start doing some preliminary analysis. Take a look right now, what's in the prior art that we think is close? And by doing that, you may be able to find out, doesn't look like anything around this invention is going to be patentable. B, you might find out that, wow, you know, everything in this space seems to be patentable because nobody's done anything like it before. Or more likely, you'll find something in the middle that shows, well, there's some similar stuff out there, and let's not put ourselves in a position where we're going to develop a product in the direction of an existing patent and have problems in terms of having an infringing product that we're developing.
Right.
And let's also try to develop our product in a way that maybe we can get our own patent. So it's different from what's in the prior art, and it's also inventive compared to that prior art. Okay. So that kind of analysis is really, really useful, so that setting aside the market value of the product in the abstract, having that additional IP value that you might be able to put on top of it could really make the difference between a successful product and a really, really successful product because of the market exclusivity you can get with the intellectual property.
Those are really good tips. So get started early with the IP production process in terms of just thinking about the analysis, what else is in the patent space already to help maybe guide your development efforts too, and also decide if it's a space that you really want to play in or not, and then seek the actual IP protection when you have enough information in place to do that, which leads me to what are those forms of IP protection, right? So as designers and product managers, what types of IP protection should we be thinking about? What are the options?
Well, one of the first options that most people want to think about and talk about is going to be patent protection, and specifically what's called utility patent protection. And when most people off the street hear the word patent, that's what we're referring to, is a utility patent. It's the idea a patent covers the utilitarian inventions. So you invent a new smartphone, that's utilitarian. You can get a utility patent on something like that. You invent a new a new app for the smartphone, that's also utilitarian because it performs a useful process. Patents are a very powerful form of intellectual property because they give you the right to exclude your competitors from the market for your invention. So I patent a new smartphone, I get to keep Samsung and Apple and HTC all out of that space if they're trying to use the same technology that's in my patent. Patent also lasts for give or take 20 years, which is a very long time to be able to have that much influence over who can and cannot participate in that market. So patents are a great option because most of the mechanical or software, chemical, biotechnology, all those sorts of inventions are going to be utilitarian, potentially patentable subject matter, and can have a really, really powerful effect on the business associated with those products. Okay. So that's sort of the starting point, I think, is utility patent protection.
Okay. So, the utility patent you said is utilitarian. You're patenting something that is a useful process, something that adds a benefit to a consumer, a user.
Yes. And more in the mechanical sense, the process sense, not just in terms of something more abstract in terms of like an aesthetic benefit, which is the subject of what's called a design patent.
Okay.
So that's a different kind of a patent, still something that you get from the patent office, but it would cover only the ornamental appearance of an object or of an interface. So I've designed a smartphone, let's say, the exterior styling of the smartphone, including, you know, how I shape the screen, how I place and arrange and shape the buttons. That would be the proper subject of a design patent, as would be the graphical user interface for any apps maybe that I design for it. So design as used in the intellectual property world is actually would be considered a misnomer by a lot of designers and product developers out there, because design often includes both form and function in the non-patent context. But in the patent world, when we say design, the patent office only recognizes that ornamental aesthetic aspect of a product or software application as being a quote design.
So to help me understand the difference between the utility patent and the design patent, because it seems like some things might overlap. I'm thinking of on my iPhone, I swipe, you know, to the left to unlock it. And Apple actually sought a patent protection for that, for, you know, swiping is their proprietary way of, you know, opening their phone. And on one hand, that offers utility, right? It's a useful process for how I unlock it. There's also the user interface design aspect of that. What type of patent would I seek for something like that?
So actually, that invention that you described would qualify for both utility patent and design patent protection. A lot of inventions actually fall into that category because, as I mentioned a moment ago, what people are actually designing is often both functional and aesthetic. So the invention of the slide to unlock feature has a utilitarian purpose. So Apple could get a patent on that particular method and that particular software implementation to serve that purpose of unlocking a phone. And at the same time, there is a stylization and a lot of aesthetic choices that they've done to make that method and that function happen. The arrangement of the button, the styling of it, all sorts of aesthetic and non-functional choices are being made by Apple to effectuate that functionality. So in theory, they could patent both the utility and the design, which is interesting because it means that they can, with the utility patent, prevent, let's say, Samsung from having a slide to unlock feature in their phone. But even if Samsung's phone did that or had that functionality, but did it in a very different way, and let's say it wasn't covered by Apple's utility patent, then if Samsung nonetheless had a slide to unlock feature that looked like Apple's and was styled like Apple's, then they would be infringing the design patent for it. So by Apple patenting both the aesthetic and the functional aspects of that same invention, they have a considerably larger scope of protection for their idea.
So we have utility patents, useful process, the design patent, the appearance, the aesthetics. Other sources of IP protection?
Yeah, there are certainly others. Trade secret is a valuable form of protection. The formula for Coca-Cola is a classic example, classic pun intended, I guess. Trade secrets can take a number of forms, whether it's particular ways that you choose to market your products or development cycles. Anything that is kept confidential and has a commercial advantage to it has the potential to be a trade secret as long as it's maintained in secret. And there are other requirements as well. There's also trademarks. Trademarks are a really valuable source of intellectual property. Trademarks are essentially brand names or logos or other things that might signify a particular source for a particular product. So let's go with Coca-Cola again. The Coca-Cola name is a famous trademark. The stylized script of the way Coca-Cola is written on the bottle is another trademark. And actually, even the shape of the Coca-Cola bottle is a way to protect Coca-Cola's trademark rights. Because, you know, if you see a Coca-Cola bottle from across the room, there is a certain distinctive shape that just looking at the shape of that bottle, you know what product is inside, even if you can't read the Coca-Cola words on it from across the room.
It's iconic.
It's iconic, exactly. And very few product shapes or packagings rise quite to the level of being that iconic. Coca-Cola is an exception in with the shape of their bottles, but the point is that it serves the same function as the name because consumers can recognize that as indicating that it comes from Coca-Cola and not from some other competitor or participant in the same market. The last form of IP would be copyright protection, which is generally referring to, you know, artistic works, sculptural works. There are forms of copyright protection in useful objects, and it's called designs for useful objects is the way the statute refers to it. Similar to a design patent, a little bit more limited and not often the best option for works of industrial design. But it's an idea worth keeping in place. Copyright is most useful, in my view, for, you know, more purely artistic works that have less functionality involved, because the Copyright Office is in the habit of not giving protection for anything that looks a little bit too functional, as opposed to something that's really driven by the aesthetics of it.
So this quickly becomes a rather complicated landscape, right? Working through utility patents, design patents, trade secrets, trademarks, and copyrights. And again, back to your advice of getting expert analysis as you start going down that path of looking at the market research, and is this a product that we want to bring to market, to start considering the options, sounds like it should be part of your product development or product management process.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not enough to just think about intellectual property protection generally, because there are a lot of different ways that intellectual property can benefit any number of products. Sometimes a product has almost no value other than marketing value. You may have come up with a better, let's say, potato peeler, but it's not particularly, you know, let's say it's not particularly novel because potato peelers have been around for a long time. The design itself is not particularly, you know, inventive, but maybe you came up with a really good marketing strategy or a really good name or a really good logo for a company that you're working with to market that product. So sometimes a trademark could be almost the entire value of a product like that. Being aware of the differences in protection that are available and the realistic chances of getting different kinds of protection, I think can really help people focus, you know, where they want to put their efforts. So having, as I said earlier, having a patent attorney or intellectual property attorney involved early can help you spot if it's worth, you know, the research and development in certain directions or not, and can counsel you on where you need to put your efforts and what steps in particular you need to take to maximize protection for whichever direction you want to go. There are certain things that you definitely do want to do if you're trying to get a patent or a trademark, and there are certain things you definitely do not want to do. if you're trying to get a patent or a trademark.
I've had a few instances where this has been an issue of my work, right? And like I said in the beginning, this does kind of make my head spin, and I am perfectly happy to engage good IP patent attorneys to help, you know, make sure the what we need done is done and done properly. It's not an area that most of us as product developers and managers, you know, play with directly. I would like to explore a real world example to, you know, just make this a little more concrete for me and the everyday innovators. Real world examples always help me understand things more completely. So we have listeners that deal with physical products that are making things like roofing materials and all kinds of physical products, and also listeners that are in the software world doing software applications. And I was trying to think of a good example to talk to you about. And the one that came to mind first was back on a Shark Tank episode. So me and my family, we love watching Shark Tank together and see the ideas shared there and the new business concepts. And this one guy came with this really simple way of hanging your glasses. If you use reading glasses, what do you do with your reading glasses when you're not wearing them, right? A really little simple magnetic hook that you can put on your shirt, and it gives you a clip to hang your glasses there, right? And I thought, you know, how many of us have had this thought before? I need some simple way of dealing with my reading glasses for those of us who have had reading glasses. And then this guy came up with this really simple idea. And, you know, within a year, his revenue went to over $1 million in the first year. And he's doing great, right? So let's talk about the simple eyeglass hook. And so maybe I'm sitting around with my buddies one evening talking about product ideas, as happens at times, and mention this one. And they go, you know, you should look into that. I think people might actually do something with that. Walk us through what might be the right steps to think about.
Sure. So first, let's start with the idea of a possible utility patent on something like that. What you want to think about is looking at past eyeglasses and eyeglass clips and various forms of eyeglasses storage. Is there something that's significantly different about that invention than what's come before? So what you could do is you could do a patent search, as we call it, and look back through prior art that we can find in this field, and it may be that nobody has ever produced a similar idea or a similar product. There are no patents or publications that we can find about it. So you may say, well, why don't we go ahead and file a patent application, see what we can get out of it?
And is that something that someone can at least get started on their own? I mean, are there sources you can go to? Right, because I, you know, I'm sitting around the table with my buddies thinking this might work, right? Then it makes sense. The next step is to do a little research if there's something like this out there yet. Before I go to the expense of getting an attorney involved, can I research this on my own?
Absolutely. And there are some great tools that we encourage a lot of our clients to use as a first pass just to get started and find out really quickly what the lay of the land might be. Google Patents actually has a great search function. The Patent Office website at uspto.gov has, you know, they're not quite as good as Google, in my opinion, but it's improved a lot in the last decade. You can search by keyword, you can search by classification, and there's a lot of ways to just hone in on at least the general class of patents and patent applications that have published in that same area. You know, a lot of people who come to me and say, oh, I have this great idea, I've never seen it out there. What they don't realize is that out there has a very different meaning, you know, to folks off the street and folks in the patent context. Whether you've seen something on the market or not is not an issue. The patent office is first going to look for publications and old patents. And the reason they do that is because those documents are very detailed, they're very well classified, and they often will reflect what was or was not on the market at the time as well. So starting with a search of your own to try to go based on keywords or classifications is a really good way to see if you have something that's at least different than what's out there already. And if you conclude that you do have something different, then maybe it's time to call a patent attorney and get a more detailed analysis and figure out if it's worthwhile to proceed. What you're going to do at that point is, let's say, you know, you and your patent attorney agree that nobody has ever made this kind of, you know, glasses clip with a magnetic attachment before. You may choose to file the application, but one of the significant hurdles that you're going to have to get over is that non-obviousness hurdle. So it may be that we're not aware of any prior art that has that exact same clip with that magnetic attachment, but the patent office often will take the position that, well, maybe it's not, maybe it hasn't been done before, but we think it's obvious. We think that magnets have been around for, you know, for basically forever. And the idea of using a magnet to attach something metal in a convenient location has also been around for a long time. If all you've done is applied that well-known technology to the context of eyeglasses, they may view that as something that's obvious and just not worthy of patent protection.
Okay.
And that's difficult. And admittedly, that's a very subjective call to make. And it would then be put back on you as the patent applicant to try to prove to the examiner that no, what we've actually done is very significant. Maybe there's something about the kind of magnet that you used. Maybe there's something about the placement of the magnet relative to, you know, the other parts of the clip that really is inventive and does solve a problem that nobody would have been able to figure out or certainly couldn't call obvious just based on the fact that magnets have been used in the past for attaching things to other things.
Okay.
So patent protection, that's sort of how I expect that would go. There may be something about the styling of the clip that would be sensible to consider a design patent for. The style of the clip might also have a particular distinctive shape that's almost like a logo. You might want to think about it from a trademark perspective too. And for a lot of inventions like that, where the technology is simple and you can imagine that the patent office might be skeptical that the quality of the innovation behind it is really to the level that they want to give a patent, design patent protection and trademark protection make a lot of sense. Maybe you come up with a good name for the product. Maybe the look of it and the look and feel of it is valuable enough in and of itself that that's enough to get you out into the marketplace and to get people to buy your product. It's not, as I said a few minutes ago, it's not always about whether the utility of the product is really leaps and bounds ahead of what's come before. Sometimes you've just got a really great marketing strategy. And if you can protect that marketing strategy in some respect, whether it's the styling of the product or the name of the product or the combination of the two, then you can get out in the market and carve out that piece of the, you know, the relevant consumer public as folks who can recognize your product for what it is.
Okay, so there are other aspects besides just the, in this example, just the actual utility of the product, holding my glasses, that we might be able to protect too. And some of those really help us establish the brand and protect the brand over time as the brand grows.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's the time frame that's involved in these things? So in the patent application process, can you just walk us through, you know, when you first do the patent application for the utility patent, and then there's a provisional period. And can you walk us through what that is involved in that time frame?
Sure. Yeah, I'm actually glad you asked that because this is really important because product development cycles and time to market can affect what makes sense from an IP standpoint. So generally, utility patents take the longest. They also, you know, last longer than at least design patents do. File a patent application today on a utilitarian invention, you're probably going to wait something like 2 to 3 years before the patent office even looks at it because they have a tremendous backlog. Hundreds of thousands of applications are filed every year, and they're always struggling to have enough examiners working at the patent office to get through all of those. Mm-hmm. So after 2 or 3 years, they look at your application. It might be another year, maybe even another 2 years of a back and forth with the patent office where they say why they think your invention is or isn't patentable, and you say in response why you think it is. Maybe you offer some evidence in support of what your belief is. So maybe it's on the order of 4 years on average, let's say, from when a patent application is filed to when you have an issued patent. So if you need protection right now, a utility patent is not necessarily going to be good for you. Now, it may be useful to have or at least to know that in the future you might get a patent so that anybody who decides that they're going to compete with you right now runs the risk of in 4 years you having this protection that could really hinder their business going forward. It's not an immediate protection that'll do you good today. Design patents are generally quicker. You file a design patent today, you might get it issued within 12 to 18 months, maybe 2 years on the outside. And the examination process is generally quicker because design patents are very focused on just the aesthetics of the object or of the user interface. So there's not quite as much in the way of prior art that they often find that's as relevant. The design patent will then last for 15 years, which is, in a way, it's almost the opposite problem of a design or of a utility patent. I mean, you may want a utility patent for a long time, but when you're talking just about aesthetics, a lot of products don't have a very long useful life just for their product stylings.
Right.
I mean, look at the fashion industry, look at the consumer electronics industry. People don't use the same user interfaces, the same clothing styles, or the same exterior moldings for consumer goods for very long. 15 years for a design patent is too much for a lot of people. But at least you can get that protection a little bit earlier than you would in other instances, like utility patents. And then trademarks are a special case, because a trademark, actually, you have rights to a trademark from the day you start using that trademark in commerce. So as soon as I start selling my product and using my new brand name or my logo on it, I start having trademark rights in it. I can also go to the Federal Trademark Office and file an application, and I certainly get extra rights based on having the Trademark Office review my application and give me a federal registration. And we generally recommend that, because the alternative is that you only have trademark rights to the extent that you have used the trademark within a geographical range. So if I only sell my product here in Pittsburgh ever, then my trademark rights are limited to Pittsburgh. But if I get a federal registration, I can get my rights nationwide from the date of my registration. So trademark rights can come up a lot quicker. Once you do apply at the trademark office, you might get your application in as little as 6 to 12 months, issued as a registration within 6 to 12 months. And at that point, you have very powerful rights to keep people from using your logo or your brand name on a similar product in the marketplace.
Thanks for walking through the timelines there. And it does sound like you have certainly an advantage as soon as you apply, but this expectation that, you know, given the utility patent 3 or 4 years, or a design patent 12 to 18 months sort of thing, that sets your expectation for when to receive the stronger protection.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good. Thanks for walking through all that a little bit. And I always like wrapping up my time with a guest talking about an innovation quote. And what was the quote that you wanted to share with us today?
Well, so when I think about innovation and when you asked me to give some thought to this, a quote that I always liked a lot was Thomas Edison and his view that genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. The reason I like that quote is because I think the vast majority of innovation that happens falls into that category, where surely there is a spark of genius, or a flash of genius, if you want to call it that. But really, I take this to mean a couple different things. One is that execution is key. Having an idea doesn't always get you there. Like me with my rotating headlights back when I was 7 years old, obviously I didn't do anything with that. But somebody did, and somebody had to put in a lot of hard work to make that idea work, to make it work well, from start to finish. So having ideas alone isn't going to get you there. But the other thing that I like to take away from Edison is that, you know, what Edison really taught me is that you can learn as much from a failure as from a success. And, you know, if you look back at the history of Edison, he tried so many different ways to come up with a filament that could possibly work as an electric light. And he never viewed that as time wasted when he failed time and time again, because he learned a whole bunch of things that don't work. Okay. And eventually was able to come up with something that did. And so I just think that's a good life lesson. It's also a good innovation lesson, that sometimes you can get as much value out of a mistake as out of getting something right the first time.
All those mistakes are great lessons. We just have to pay attention.
Absolutely. Well,
thanks so much for talking through some of the issues involved in IP protection for product managers. Want to make sure we just wrap this up so that people know how to find out more about the work that you do, and if there's any last thoughts that you want to leave listeners with.
Sure. I think it would be great for your listeners just to give some thought to intellectual property. Read up on it a little bit more after listening to this interview, and figure out what it might be able to do for you, and also figure out what it might be able to do to you. For all you know, there may be other intellectual property out there that should be of concern or that you might want to license. Just being aware of intellectual property is a good thing, and a baseline understanding of how it works and what it can do for you can be a really empowering thing. So getting yourself up to speed will always be a valuable service that you can do for yourself or for your business or for your clients. And to the extent that you at least know when you might need a lawyer, then that's half the battle.
And how to follow your work?
You can follow my work. My firm website will point you to a little more information about me. It's at www.weblaw.com, and that's weblaw.com. You can find my professional profile on there and some links to some articles that I've published over the years. You can also, I invite any of your listeners to reach out to me at my email address on the website if they have follow-up questions about any intellectual property concerns.
Very good. Dan, thanks so much for being with us today and helping to clarify some of the issues going on with IP protection.
My pleasure, Chad. Thank you.
Everyday Innovators, thank you so much for listening and telling your colleagues about this podcast. Find the show notes and details of the discussion at theeverydayinnovator.com/039. And thanks to productinnovationeducators.com, your one source for online product management and innovation training.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training Your Customers Will Love You For. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.